This is Active Ingredients. At the time this recording was made, Paco Whelan spoke with journalist and filmmaker Kevin Pena, who was in Northampton to introduce his latest project, Haiti, The Untold Story, documenting human rights abuses at the hands of the Haitian police, military, and Jordanian UN troops. These forces, sometimes wearing black masks to conceal their identities, would fire scoped M16 rifles at peaceful demonstrators, including women, children, and others, as they demanded the return of their democratically elected president, Aristide. You can visit Kevin Pena's website at www.haitiaction.net.
So we're here today thanks to Ed Russell and Active Ingredients for conversation with Kevin Pena. Kevin is visiting Northampton to introduce a new film he's made, Haiti, The Untold Story. I came upon Kevin quite circuitously when I asked people all over the country, what was the best film to see about Haiti? And they said, Kevin Pena's film, Haiti, Harvest of Hope. And I couldn't find it. Nobody had it. I went all over the place. And finally, somehow or other, one night about 2 weeks ago, Kevin Pena called me to say, I have a film, but I have a new film that I can actually introduce myself if you'd like to invite me to come. So I spoke to a few people and we were all delighted to have not only his new film, but Kevin Pena to introduce it and to talk about his work, which I think is remarkable. So I'd like to ask you, Kevin, to tell us in your own story, in your own words, how you came to be this documentary filmmaker who is so alive with the enthusiasm you have for the work you're doing for justice.
Well, I first went to El Salvador. Really, there were only two things going on at that time for people who were involved in the issue of El Salvador that I knew of. One of them was guns, and the other one was cameras. And I'm not comfortable with guns. I don't believe in violence. I don't adhere to that as a solution to any problem. And so I decided to pick up the camera, and I thought that that was the best way that I could contribute to the Salvadoran struggle, was to combat the lies of the Reagan administration. Of course, the Reagan administration at that time was trying to portray the FMLN as godless communists. And I wanted to do exactly the opposite, which was to give them a human face and to show people in this country that we were talking about real living human beings, not people who, as our government was portraying them, somehow deserve to die or deserve what they got, I guess is more appropriate. And it was really the experience of Archbishop Romero, and having been a disaffected Catholic for many years, and then coming in touch with this new idea of liberation theology as I saw it unfolding in El Salvador was inspiring to me, and led me, I guess, on this path. And it's what got me into filmmaking. And then after the film on El Salvador, I was hired and brought in as a producer of a film called Berkeley in the 60s, which was about the free speech movement at Berkeley, stop the draft protests, the Black Panthers, and what happened in Berkeley. And my reputation in helping to finish that film as a producer got me a job on another film called Amazonia, Voices from the Rainforest, which was an interesting film too because it focused on the Iruiwawao and the Yanomami tribes in the rainforest dying. This was a film that addressed the fact that there were indigenous people in the forest who were on the front lines of defense of the forest and were dying for defending the forest because it was their way of life. Their way of life is so intricately bound to the forest that they're inseparable. Chico Mendez was in that film. That was a real eye-opener. Chico Mendez, of course, led a movement against the cattle ranchers who were encroaching on indigenous lands, and he was murdered for that. Archbishop Romero was murdered in El Salvador. Chico Mendez was murdered in Brazil. And after Amazonia, Voices from the Rainforest, I heard about this priest. It's like 19, what, before actually Amazonia Voices from the Rainforest, I had heard about this priest in Haiti, Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide, and I started doing research and made a trip to Haiti. And then suddenly my film became, that was my next film, and it was chronicling Aristide's presidency, his first 6 months in office, the changes that he was bringing to the country as the first democratically elected president in 186 years. And while I was finishing that film, cutting it, I get a call from my friend Claudette Ourlet in Haiti, and she says, something's going on. And sure enough, that night there was a coup, and Aristide was forced out of the country. And I arrived 2 days later, October the 2nd. The coup was September the 30th, 1991. I arrived 2 days later. The tarmac of the airport had been closed, but the general who had overthrown Aristide, his name was General Raul Cedras. His brother ran a private jet service, ferrying journalists and rich families in and out of the country, and was turning a profit off of it. And so Madsen, who was one of the industrialist families of Haiti, Mr. Madsen took pity on me after I begged him, and he got me a spot on his private jet coming back from Miami that he had rented from Cedras's brother, at least from Cedras's brother. So they allowed us to land on the tarmac. I then spent 3 weeks of hell, basically, chronicling the military as it just slaughtered the population. My friends in hiding, because of course I'd spent 6 months chronicling Aristide's presidency, so I'd made a lot of friends, and suddenly I'm seeing their faces flashed on the television for their arrest, with arrest warrants, people in hiding, lots of people being just gunned down in the streets. And I remember that this was probably the first big disconnect I had with the press in Haiti, the so-called corporate media, the so-called commercial media. And that was, they were reporting that during the first 2 weeks of the coup, only 200 people had been killed. Well, I bribed my way into the general hospital morgue, and I found two 20 by 20 foot rooms with 12 foot high ceilings, and we stopped counting at 1,500, and there were still more bodies lined up at the back door. And so this was the first real disconnect I had between what the press was reporting, the Associated Press, Reuters, CNN, et al., versus what the reality that I was documenting with my own cameras and discovering on my own. There was this real disconnect, and that was one of many, many more experiences to come in terms of understanding how the press, when it comes to Haiti, doesn't tell the truth. And how my experiences don't confirm what they're saying, but instead unearth another reality. And so then Aristide spent 3 years in exile. I went back in 1993 after those first 3 weeks after the coup. I went back in 1993 because there had just been the Governor's Island Accord, where the Clinton administration was trying to negotiate between Aristide and General Cedras for Aristide's return. And a year and a half earlier, when I'd gotten back from the coup, I ran out of money and I had to go to Los Angeles to do more fundraising. And while I was editing that fundraising piece, I got a call in my editing room by a man who introduced himself as Lynn Garrison. And he said that he was an art gallery owner in Santa Monica, and he said that General Cedras had allowed him to rummage through Aristide's residence after Aristide was forced out, and that he had found that Aristide was taking a cocktail of 12 different drugs for mental instability, that Aristide had been hospitalized in a Canadian mental institution, and too bad the Haitian people had wasted their first real shot at democracy on such a loser. To which I responded, well, you know, you say you found these things, send me some evidence, send me prescription, send me a copy of this document you say about him being hospitalized in a Canadian mental institution. And we left it at that. And about a week went by and I didn't receive anything from him, gave him a fax number, and he calls me back and he leans into me even harder and says, you know, you've just got to tell the truth. You've really got to tell the truth about this loser. To which I reply, but you never sent me the stuff you promised me. How do I know that you're telling the truth? And he just basically said, I don't have to tell you an effing thing. F you, be sure you're careful the next time you go to Haiti, and hung up the phone on me. So now you flash forward back to 1993, and I'm going there with Fox Television News credentials, working for Fox TV News, and I'm going to do an interview with the general. And as I go into the general's office, there's this office before his office, a sort of antechamber, and there's this elderly white guy who's barking orders on the telephone, and he's selling parts for Jeeps, and gosh, it's hard to remember exactly, but I was really just like, who is this guy? He's so up in the military's business, and it's obvious he's talking to military personnel and barking orders. And while I'm sitting in front of him, while he's on the phone, he gets Jesse Helms on the phone, and he gets Strom Thurmond on the phone. And I'm, you know, at this point, I can tell that this is a little theater for my benefit to show me how important he is. And I still don't know who he is. So he gets off the phone and he turns to me and he says, "Hi, I'm Lynn Garrison," the same guy who had threatened me a year and a half earlier. And of course, my quiet internal mantra was, "Please don't let him remember. Please don't let him remember." He says, "Well, do you have your questions for the general?" I say, "Sure." He says, "Well, you need to go back to your hotel room and we'll call you." So he took the questions and I went back to my hotel and they call me and he says, "Well, come on over. We want to talk to you about the interview." And before I went, I was so scared that I called a couple friends of mine to ask them their advice. Father Jean-Marie Vincent, who was one of my first mentors in Haiti. He was assassinated August 22nd, 1994. And Georges Ouellet, who was husband of a dear friend of mine, Claudette, who would later serve as a prime minister. And I asked him, "Hey, this guy, like, threatened me, you know, a year and a half earlier while I was editing this film. What do I do? Should I go back?" And they're like, "Well, we think it'll be okay. You've got Fox TV credentials. It should be okay." So remember, this was Fox before Fox became Fox, as you know it today. So I go back. And he says, "I'm really sorry, Kevin, but the general's interpreter has laryngitis." I'm like, "Whoa, well, my interpreter worked for the general before. Can we use him?" He says, "Oh, no. He'll only work with this interpreter." And I say, "Okay, thank you. But in the meantime, I'm sort of grateful. Well, he didn't remember who I am and that he threatened me." So as I'm on my way out the door, he says, "Hey, Kevin, by the way, how's your film?" I turn and I say, "Well, you know, I'm not really here for that. I'm here doing Fox TV news business, and, you know, I was here to interview the general, and thanks very much." And so as I leave, these very four large soldiers with huge guns start following me down the steps. And as I'm walking down, a friend of mine from CBS is walking up, and I ask him, "Hey, what's going on?" He says, "I'm going to interview the general." So obviously this laryngitis story was a lie, but I asked him, "Hey, as a courtesy, will you do me a favor and walk me down to my fellows in my van, because these guys are following me and this doesn't feel right." And he did. So they got me out of there. And then I went to the Haitian parliament. And right after the coup, there was this one senator who worked with the supporters of the coup. His name was Senator Thomas Eddie Dupuytren. And he helped to put this veneer of legitimacy by having the so-called parliament vote that Aristide had left the country, had vacated his position, as if a coup somehow were voluntarily vacating your position. Anyway, so everywhere I went, it was like magic. This guy would show up to say the most god-awful stupid things. But it became a key element in Harvest of Hope, this guy, Senator Thomas Eddie Dupuytren. So in 93, I thought, well, since I couldn't interview General Cedras, maybe I'll go down to the parliament and see if I can dig this guy up again. So I go down to the parliament and I make an appointment with Senator Dupuytren to go to his house that night to interview him. And as I'm interviewing him, the lights go out. And somebody in the street starts calling my name. And I go up to find out who's calling my name. I go walk through the door to the front of his house. And I don't know that the senator's standing behind me. There's a kid who comes from the street who's on the left of me, a kid who's on the right. And we're listening to see who this is screaming my name out in the street. And as I'm standing, there are two-door Daihatsu drives by. And I see the gun come out in slow motion. And they fire four times. They shoot the kid on the left in the neck. They shoot the kid on the right in the foot. I hit the ground and they shoot the senator twice in the forearm. After the fourth shot, the senator says, "Don't fire, it's me." And they never fire the fifth and sixth shot. And I survived a drive-by shooting. So the kid who was shot in the neck, his mother comes, I guess she was in the neighborhood. She comes running and begs the senator to take her son to the hospital with him because he's getting in the car because he's been shot in the forearm twice. And so I take this young kid and we take him in our van. And it was really strange. They had taken nails with rubber bands and they had created these like spiked balls. And they had thrown them throughout the street in front of the house as well. So we got this flat tires. The tires literally sheared off the car as we got to the hospital with this kid. And his aorta had been nicked and his spine had been nicked. So just blood everywhere. And I'm pressing on his neck to keep him from bleeding to death. And as we arrive at the hospital, the senator is standing there like he's, and he wants us to start interviewing him. Like it's a photo opportunity while this kid is bleeding to death. And I just tell him, get the hell out of the way. And we take this kid upstairs and the doctors don't want to treat him. I start screaming and the doctors start treating him. And next thing I know, my cameraman grabs me by the scruff of the neck and says, we have to go. The police are on their way to arrest you. They've already been to your hotel twice looking for you. And, as coincidence would have it, they'd already been to my hotel to arrest me before the shooting incident. And so, make a long story short, I ended up having to undergo... I had to take refuge in my own embassy, because my own embassy wanted to turn me over to the police. They said that I was being accused of a serious crime, because General Cedras got on the television the next morning with my photograph and accused me of the attempted assassination of the senator. And so the embassy said that was a serious charge. Of course, it's like, you know, it's kind of classic blame the victim, right? They try to get you and they miss and they get their own guy and they accuse you of, it's a monkey business. But at any rate, so I have friends in Congress and in the Senate, and I called them, demanded a phone call, because the U.S. Embassy's point of view was, you know, do you have a good Haitian attorney? And I'm just like, you gotta be out of your mind. I'm not gonna go to court under a military dictatorship, you know? And so some friends in Congress and the Senate pressured them to allow, I had to literally ask for asylum in my own embassy. I had to officially ask for asylum in my own embassy, which is unheard of. And then they did this thing where I had to undergo questioning for like, I forget, it was a long time, 4 or 5 hours. Ridiculous questioning meant to make me implicate myself in the attempted assassination of this guy, which is a complete joke because, you know, it was quite clear from him that he knew the guys who did this from what he screamed after they fired and that he was not the target, the intended target. So they do this thing called wheels up and they put me on the plane and the Marines don't leave the tarmac until the wheels of the plane leave the tarmac and they deported me, and I wasn't able to return to Haiti until Aristide returned in 1994, and that was the last shot of Harvest of Hope.
And when you were talking about your being accused of shooting the senator, I immediately flashed on Father Jean Juste, who is currently in jail in Haiti, accused of shooting of a murder. And I wonder if this might be an opportunity to fast forward to 2004-5. And Kevin Pena is living again in Haiti. And if you could talk a little about how things are in Haiti now and what you're experiencing of both the political and personal realities.
Well, just to address the question of Father Gerard Jean-Juste, I first met him while I was making Harvest of Hope in 1991. He was then in the capital of Port-au-Prince. Really feisty guy. He was helping people who were being hunted down by the brutal military dictatorship to go into hiding. And his thing was, you know, okay, so we have to hide, but let's not leave Haiti. Let's stay here and let's resist. He was accused of being involved in the murder of a journalist, Jack Roche, when he wasn't even in the country at the time. But that's not really what they charged him with. What they charged him with was a law under the Napoleonic Codes, which rule Haiti's judicial system. And it's called clamor public, which means public clamor. What it says is that if enough people accuse you of a crime in public, that whether they have evidence or not, the authorities have the right to incarcerate you. That's the actual law under which Father Gerard Jean-Just was first apprehended by the United Nations and then handed over to the Haitian police for clamor public. And the so-called student movement that had been part of the opposition calling for Aristide's resignation, they go by the acronym GNB, which really is a horrible name. I'll say it in a nice way. It means testicles up your derriere movement. Means that no one can strike you in your most vulnerable location. Of course, they were heavily funded by Andy Appeth, the sweatshop owner who was the leader of the so-called Civil Society Initiative, the Group 184, as well as heavily funded by the United States Agency for International Development, money from the European Union, supplied by France, and by Canada and the Canadian International Development Agency. The shock troops of this group called the GMB, as Father Gerard Jean-Just was paying his respects to Jacques Roche in the Saint-Pierre Church in Pétionville. These guys are really fascists. They're brown shirts, right? They go into the church. They start beating Father Jean-Just. Then they lead this chant for his arrest, accusing him of being involved in the killing of this journalist, Jacques Roche. The United Nations are present. They go in to intervene because they're beating Father at this point. They grab him, and it appears as if they're going to do this for his own protection. But then shortly thereafter, they turn him directly over to the Haitian police, and he's charged for clamor public. So he spent 2.5 months in jail. It's been very difficult to watch, as it's difficult to watch most of the Lavalas political prisoners. These are people who are in jail for no other reasons than their political beliefs, their political affiliations, false accusations made against them. Another example is Annette Auguste, the 70-year-old grandmother, who was arrested May the 10th by U.S. Marines, who at the time justified her incarceration by saying that she was conspiring with local Muslims in a local mosque to attack U.S. forces. They dropped that, of course, because it was ludicrous. And the second charge became that she had held a voodoo ceremony in Aristide's residence and had murdered a baby by crushing it mortar and pestle style so that Aristide could drink the blood in order to seal a pact with the devil, his reelection. Who wrote that false charge? A man named Ramon Joseph, who's the publisher of the Haiti Observator, which was a right-wing rag that was an apologist for the military dictatorship after the first coup in 1991. Where is Ramon Joseph today? He's the Haitian ambassador to Washington, D.C. Those are just two examples of just trumped-up charges. And it's sad to watch these people because you've got to understand that psychologically, being behind bars day after day with nothing to do except know and think about the fact that you're innocent and that your accusers are so vindictive and so manipulative and so evil, really. It wears on you psychologically. I mean, I only spent 3 days in jail from September the 9th to the 12th, and that wore on me, knowing that I was innocent. And I know that Father Gerard Jean-Just's health has suffered because of it, as well as Annette Auguste. Her health has suffered because of it. She's now tremendously overweight. We worry about her because she's developing diabetes. This woman used to have large bright, beautiful eyes because of the lack of sunlight and light in general. Her eyes have just grown so small, the pupils of her eyes. She doesn't look healthy. And yet when you talk to her, she has this beautiful, bright spirit, just as Father Gerard Jean-Just continues to have. But you know that they're suffering. They can't help but suffer under those conditions.
You know, we visited her in prison when our local raging grannies went to Haiti. I was so moved by her because as we walked in, six white-haired and white women from the U.S. walked in. She began singing and all the women in the prison, and we sang together. So when you talk about her, I have this picture of her sitting there and not having seen her looking healthy. I was just so moved by her spirit. And of course, when we heard that there was a possibility that Gerard Jean-Just might run for president and that she might run for the Senate. Oh, it was such a high moment here for those of us who have met them and who cherish them.
They will never let those people out of jail as long as there's a possibility that they can still continue to inspire the base of Love Alas. Now, you've got to also remember that the United States, France, and Canada, who were behind the ouster of Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide, and now all of this being added, giving the added veneer of legitimacy by the United Nations, they're trying to ignore that there are political prisoners. Paul Martin of Canada said there are no political prisoners in Haiti. Because, of course, the Canadians have all of these technicians that the Canadian International Development Agency are paying to reform the judicial system. And, of course, the United States Agency for International Development and their technicians are involved as well. And they pat themselves on the back and they say, we're doing a good job for democracy in Haiti because we're helping to reform the judicial system. But when you raise the question of political prisoners with them, they wash their hands of any responsibility and any culpability, despite the fact that it's their guns, it's their power that are enabling, that are keeping in power this corrupt government, this brutal government that is responsible for the political prisoners. So they want it both ways. On one hand, they want to talk about how they're building democracy, but when it comes to bringing up the reality of political prisoners, they want to ignore that that exists and that they have any culpability or responsibility for it. It's the same thing with the brutality of the Haitian police. The Haitian police have fired unarmed demonstrators. They have committed summary executions and brutal murders in poor neighborhoods where people who are the base of Love Alas continue to turn out in the thousands to demand the return of Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide and the restoration of democracy to Haiti. And the police have gone in there and they have slaughtered innocents to terrorize the population, to terrorize people, to stop these demonstrations calling for Aristide's return. There are 100 RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who are involved in the training directly of the Haitian National Police. There are U.S. advisors, even some from the State Department, who are involved in the training of the Haitian National Police. They pat themselves on the back again and say, we're reforming the Haitian National Police and we're training them because this is about building democracy in Haiti. But again, when they commit these heinous crimes, when they commit these gross human rights violations, they wash their hands of any responsibility or culpability.
When you were talking about the governments that you made reference to, and I'd like you to say a little more if you would, the Canadian government, the French government, and the U.S., mm-hmm. If you want to say something about the U.N.'s role here too. But it's interesting when we can think about how the United States and France are at odds over Iraq, and yet they can come together over what they're doing in Haiti. It's an amazing geopolitical maneuver, and if you could.
Well, you know, there's the Monroe Doctrine, which of course has ruled Latin America and the Caribbean, you know, for over a century now. Its anniversary is coming up on December the 2nd. And you got to remember that the French still have colonies in the Caribbean. So there's been a long term collaboration and accommodation between U.S. foreign policy and the Monroe Doctrine and French colonialism in the region. So that's one reason why it's different than, let's say, over the situation in Iraq, where French oil companies were working with the Iraqi government under Saddam Hussein and wanted to protect their part of the piece of the cake against U.S. oil interests, who now, of course, control the whole cake. Well, we'll see, but for the time being, appear to be trying to control the whole cake. So historically, there's always been this accommodation between U.S. foreign policy and French colonialism in the Caribbean. Canada's interesting because Canada's perfect, because Canada's a country, a nation that has one foot in the Anglophone world and one foot in the Francophone world. So it's the perfect twain between the partnership of the United States, U.S. colonialism in the region, U.S. imperialism in the region, and French colonialism and imperialism in the region, which, as I said earlier, have always had this historical accommodation. Of course, Haiti was a former French colony. So there are those ties historically. We also know that the French government was livid with Aristide, that one of the reasons that they despised him and had this visceral hatred for him was because he had called to question the restitution that the Haitian government was forced to pay the slaveholding class of the French after the Haitian Revolution in order for France to recognize them as a free and independent nation.
Kevin, let me just interrupt you for a moment, because I think that's a very important point that we don't know much about. If you could just talk a little about that whole restoration issue with regard to the people of Haiti.
As I said, the French would not recognize Haiti as an independent country until the Haitian government, under Boyer, paid restitution compensation to the slaveholders whose land was lost by virtue of the world's only successful slave revolution and the world's first black republic. Aristide calculated that at today's rate with interest, that would total more than $54 billion. And he demanded reparations from France for that money. And the French government hated him. The French left intelligentsia hated him, because it's one thing to feign socialism or feign for social justice in the world. It's quite another to ask for actual reparations, demand that of a former slaveholding nation, as Aristide did. So that explains a little bit of France's motivation for wanting to oust Aristide. The United States is a little more complex, because it really goes to the heart of U.S. foreign policy and the history of U.S. foreign policy in the region. We know that popular democracy has always been anathema to U.S. foreign policy interests. And the way that I define popular democracy is a democratically elected government that's more beholden to the interests of its own constituency and people than it is to U.S. foreign policy interests. And whether you go to the example in 1954 of the CIA-engineered coup against Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, or whether you go to the example of Juan Bosch in the Dominican Republic in 1965, or you go to the example of Salvador Allende and yet another CIA-engineered coup against his democratically elected government in Chile in 1973, or today's contemporary example of the destabilization campaign against the democratically elected government of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, there is a pattern to how U.S. foreign policy will not tolerate leaders or democratic movements that do not adhere, play within the box of the rules that the U.S. embassy and U.S. foreign policy dictates in the region. Aristide and Haiti were no different. Aristide showed too much independence. Aristide reneged on his agreement, his IMF and World Bank agreements, to privatize state industries, and instead took the profit and plowed them into a universal literacy program, modeled after the Cubans' literacy program, where every adult between the ages of 30 to 60 could go to a free literacy class every day. Also created these alpha restos, where for a few pennies, people who couldn't afford a meal could get a full plate of food with a little bit of meat and a big plate of rice. If you couldn't afford a meal, you could go to these alpha restos, because the literacy centers also served as these alpha restos, these popular restaurants. An example is in Pétionville, which is considered a wealthy suburb where the wealthy live, but it's surrounded by poor people who still live in abject poverty. That neighborhood was serving 7,000 meals a day to the poor, with 600 plates reserved for the most malnourished children, special vitamin supplements. I mean, I know, because I chronicled. I was one of the only people in the world to document that literacy program. And so, two things you don't do in Latin America and the Caribbean. One is you don't renege on your IMF World Bank agreements. And the second is you don't take profits from state-run industries to pay for social services like universal literacy programs. Now, remember that when Aristide was first elected in 1990, the illiteracy rate in Haiti was 90%. The date that he was ousted by the U.S., France, and Canada, February 29, 2004, that rate had lowered to 45%. So it had had a tremendous impact on Haitian society overall, and especially on the poor and the peasants in the countryside. And so it's no coincidence that the very first ministry that the U.S. installed government of Gerard Latortue abolished upon seizing power after Aristide was forced out was the Ministry of Literacy.
This is Active Ingredients. You are listening to Paki Wieland speaking with journalist and filmmaker Kevin Pena.
So you continue to be in Haiti, continue to work there. You're a North American. What keeps you in Haiti?
Well, my wife is Haitian. Our son was born there. My in-laws are Haitian. Most of my dearest friends in the world are Haitian, even though I've lost quite a few over the last couple of years, or my friends are in jail behind bars. I'm not going to let them frighten me, even though I'm a journalist and a documentary filmmaker. I'm not going to let them frighten me into disavowing my friendship with Father Gerard Jean-Just, or disavowing my friendship with Annette Auguste, or disavowing my friendship with Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune. These are people that I care about. These are people that I respect. These are people that I've known for many, many years. I guess it's that things are not resolved, and I want to continue to give a voice to the voiceless. I want to continue to use my white privilege and my U.S. passport against the bullies in Haiti. I want to push the line, if you will, to see just how far I can take it and how far they will let me go in terms of... I let them know my utter disdain for them. I mean, I let them know my utter disgust for them. I don't hate them, but that doesn't mean that I have to like them or respect them. You know, I don't want any harm to come to them, but I don't respect them at all. And they know that. They know that I disdain them. And I have done my best over this last year and a half to show the world. And before that, when the destabilization campaign was happening against Aristide, I was one of the few voices in the wilderness who was screaming about how there were these paramilitary forces, death squads in the Dominican Republic, who were coming into Haiti and using the Dominican Republic as a safe haven, and were being given protection by the U.S. Embassy and by the Dominican military. You know, I was called a conspiracy theorist, but that's exactly what happened, that, you know, just before Aristide was forced out, those forces that had been using the DR as a safe haven came over the border and started taking over Haitian towns with brand new M16s in their hands. Anyway, the point is that the media, the mainstream media, the corporate media has a bias. They do not tell the whole story. They do not tell the truth, in my opinion, about what's going on in Haiti. I have countless examples. I'll just throw one more out at you. When they said that Aristide had lost the support of his people because there were these massive demonstrations in the streets demanding his resignation. Well, I went to those opposition demonstrations, you know. You'd meet at the Hotel Montana. There'd be these beautiful women who spoke three languages who would have a nice press packet ready for you. They'd serve you coffee and a croissant. You'd get into an air-conditioned bus. They would drive you down to the demonstration where Andy Appad or various leaders, so-called leaders who were demanding Aristide's resignation were assembled to give you interviews. Then you would follow the demonstration. And then they'd put you back in the bus, you'd go back to your hotel, and you'd follow your story. Well, during the same period, there were much larger demonstrations in the streets of people demanding that Aristide be able to fulfill his 5-year term in office. And while the press were falling over themselves to get their coffee and croissant and show these photos of the opposition against Aristide, because somehow they viewed this as a sexier story, they utterly, completely ignored the much larger demonstrations, and you never saw a single image published of them anywhere. And you would have never known that they had existed. And in many times I was the only reporter there with a camera during these larger demonstrations. And there's another dynamic that was at work here, and part of it is fear of the poor, and part of it is fear of black people. You know, there's nothing that's going to frighten, you know, anybody worse than a bunch of angry, pissed off poor people in the streets demanding their rights. There's nothing that's going to frighten a white reporter more, even more than that, than a bunch of angry, pissed off black poor people in the streets demanding their rights. And they were literally afraid. Even though I would make offers to guarantee their personal security to come cover those stories, I got very few takers. But so I'm trying to show you that there is a slant in the media and a frame of reference from which they report that has led me in my own personal campaign to combat with the truth, to show that side of the story which is not being told. And really, that's what this film, The Untold Story, is about. The part of the story that we have not been told by the mainstream media about what has occurred in Haiti after Aristide's forced ouster, February 29, 2004.
So this whole issue of the media, could we stay with that a little more? And the question of the interest of the international press and whose interest they're serving.
I don't know if it's, I mean, I can't say exactly whose interests they're serving, but I can describe to you the way that what I saw and what I've experienced with them that may point to what their interests are. Another example is the literacy program. I had a friend who was the Reuters correspondent, and he wanted to learn about the literacy program. So I took him, he went, he saw it, those alpha restos I described, he went, he saw them, he said, "This is fantastic. No one's ever written about this in the mainstream media, so yes. I'm going to have a coup here, you know?" I'm like, "Go, that's fantastic, you know? Nobody listens to me anyway. Go ahead, write it, you know, for Reuters." And so he writes the story. It's a great piece. I read it. It's not very long, 700, 800, 800 words, but it's great. You know, it really captures the essence of what this program's about, and he submits it to his editors, and, you know, he submits it not once, not twice, but three times. And finally, I ask him, like a week later, "What happened to the story? It was great." And he said, "My editors told me point blank, we are not interested in positive stories about Lavalas." Quote from his editors in Miami. You know, and I gave you the example of the demonstrations, how they would only really play to the opposition demonstrations and not cover the much larger demonstrations demanding that Aristide be able to continue his term in office. And there was another reason for this, which is that Haitian media is primarily, Haitian communication is primarily radio. And there are very few independent stations, meaning stations that aren't owned by the same traditional reactionary wealthy elite. The APED, for example, APED started Tel Haïti. He's also has a controlling interest in Radio Vision 2000, Andy APED, who was the leader of the so-called civil society group that was demanding Aristide's resignation. You know, there's Radio Metropole, there's Radio Kiskaya, Radio Signal FM. These are all owned by the elite. They actually created an organization called the Association of Haitian Media Owners, where 20 out of 25 stations in the capital are part of this association. Well, the way that it would work, and the way that it would work with the international press, is that when there were the opposition demonstrations, these elite-run radio stations would cover every chant and every nuance from A to Z, sometimes 4 to 5 hours of programming of an opposition march. Every chant, every nuance. When there were these much larger marches demanding Aristide fulfill his term, they would play music all day and you wouldn't hear a single reference to it. It mirrored the attention of the international media because they were doing the same thing. They were covering everything that was going on with the opposition marches and completely ignoring what was going on with the pro-Lavalas, pro-Aristide marches. But it also got to the point where when the radio stations, those same radio stations would, under the guise of news, use innuendo and gossip and rumor and unsubstantiated claims. And I'll give you a specific example. In January of 2004, there were these so-called student demonstrations by the GNB, the Grenan Boudin, the Testicles Up Your Derriere movement, demanding Aristide's resignation. And the students claimed when they were breaking windows in cars and they were getting arrested by the cops for breaking things, they were claiming that the Haitian police were putting them in the back of vans and were injecting them with a syringe with an unknown substance. And this was a big deal in the Haitian press. The Haitian police, Aristide's government, are injecting students with poison some of them said, Radio Metropole, with poison. Nancy Rock, the supposed great impartial journalist who has won these awards, was saying, well, the Aristide government is injecting these students with poison. Suddenly it appears in AP and Reuters, quoting, right, members of the opposition who are now also parroting this, and it's on the elite-run radio stations, Aristide's government and the police are injecting these students with poison, right? After several of the radio stations initiated that report, put several of these students making this false accusation on the air, it appears in AP and Reuters, but then the day after, the very same stations who had begun the rumor were now quoting AP and Reuters as a source. So there was this positive feedback loop of disinformation that was created between the Associated Press, Reuters, and the elite-run radio stations in the capital. And it worked like a charm, and it worked over and over and over and over again until you didn't know what the truth. Luckily, I spent a lot of my time recording hours and hours and hours of those broadcasts so that I would have archives, so that when I write my book, guys, watch out, because I'm going to be quoting you guys, and I'm going to be calling you on the carpet, because you know what I'm saying is true. I'm talking to those Haitian media owners, and I'm talking to reporters like Lillian Pierre-Paul and Nancy Rock. I recorded them, folks, and I'm going to throw them back in your face and show exactly how you pulled this off with a big lie.
Let me just ask you a question. When Jean-Bertrand Aristide was a priest in one of the poorest parishes in Port-au-Prince, one of the poorest nation in Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, he was enamored of liberation theology and the preferential treatment of the poor. This amazing thing happened. He went from being this dedicated, committed parish priest to the president of the government of the nation of Haiti, and implemented, among other things, the literacy and food programs for the hungry. That Haiti even emerged, even with the bad press, it's now in our consciousness. And that not only was this Jean-Bertrand Aristide elected, he was elected twice, and one of his supporters was elected in between his oust. And I wonder how you understand this phenomenon, and where do you find hope for this continuing, not only in Haiti, but in other parts of the world, particularly in the Caribbean, that can give us encouragement as we struggle on so many different fronts for justice.
These days, when I talk about Haiti and when I think about Haiti, it's difficult to see the hope. It's difficult to find hope in that situation. And I have to recall and I have to remember these massive demonstrations that were mounted after the ouster of Aristide in neighborhoods like Cité Soleil, Bel Air, Solino, Matissan, where people would come out in huge numbers demanding his return, demanding the restoration of democracy. They were gunned down for it. They've been brutalized for it. And yet, you see them get up and do it again, and again, and again, and again. And so the only place that I've found hope in Haiti, for example, has been in the resiliency of the spirit of those people, knowing, I mean, how much courage must it take to take to the streets knowing that there's a good possibility that you're going to be shot by the police for doing so? It's an incredible amount of courage, and I guess if there's any place that I'm hopeful, it's that in Haiti, I have not seen the state, this brutal state apparatus, be able to extinguish that spirit, because people continue to get up and do it again and again and again. And I guess it's that indomitable spirit that if there's any hope for me, it would be that. But I also think that that's not just the spirit of Haitian people. Certainly the Haitian people have their own unique way of expressing that spirit. But I believe that that's all people. All people have that spirit when we're confronted with tormentors, when we're confronted with oppressors. That's when we are at our best, when we sacrifice for others, when we sacrifice for our children, when we sacrifice for out of love. That is when the human spirit is at its best, because that is when it meets its greatest test.
Well, I appreciate everything you've had to say today. And as I listen to you and think about, reflect on the work you're doing, how I see that really a reflection of that giving voice to the voiceless and allowing people who otherwise would not have their stories told, who do get up time and time again to just keep on working for freedom, working for justice.
Just got to say, though, it's really important to understand that I don't work alone, that I couldn't possibly do what I do or have survived what I've survived in Haiti if not for astounding, marvelous, incredibly courageous Haitian brothers and sisters who work side by side with me.
Yes. Yes, thanks. That's an oftentimes overlooked dimension, the necessity for community, for that mutual support. So thanks for bringing that up, raising that. And thanks for sharing these wonderful stories with us. And we wish you well. And know that those of us that I and those of us who are listening to you are right there supporting you too.
Thank you.
Do you have a website?
Yeah, www.haitiaction.net or www.telejaw.net. Telejaw is spelled TELEDYOL.
I, for one, certainly can say, as I look around and think, oh my God, where are we going? What are sources of hope? That I think if there could be a UN that actually was a United Nations, that could be, that's one of the places I could see implementing justice on this planet. Now, as you recoiled from that, I understand that the UN today is not that organization, is not that institution, and you certainly have spoken out against and certainly have demonstrated in your own films what the UN has done that are atrocities. And I wonder if you have anything you want to say about that, about the UN.
The UN right now, I mean, at first it was that they were providing cover and adding legitimacy to the coup, February 29, 2004, that ousted Aristide. But then their role, as it evolved, became more actively a part of the campaign of repression, the campaign of extermination against Jean-Bertrand Aristide's La Valasse party, the majority political party in Haiti. It started with the Haitian police and the UN going to demonstrations together. Suddenly the UN would disappear and the Haitian police would start firing on the crowd. Headshots, right? Shooting people in the head in those demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations. Then it evolved to another phase that I recognized, that I identified, which was that the Haitian police and the UN would come together. This time the UN would not disappear. And in front of them, without their intervention, the Haitian police would begin to shoot and kill people. And then the third and final phase, which we've documented, is where the UN now stands accused of entering those poor neighborhoods that have been launching sites for demonstrations demanding Aristide's return, Cité Soleil in specific, and targeting unarmed civilians with headshots. That's what's in the untold story, is that proof, that documentation of a massacre committed by the United Nations, not by the Haitian police, on July the 6th of this year. Why? People might ask, well, why? And I know some people will not be satisfied with this answer, but it's the only answer I can come up with. Because if every time Lavalas demonstrates, every time those people mass in the streets to demand Aristide's return, it exposes the lie that Aristide had lost the support of his people. That was the main justification that the United States, France, and Canada, and now the UN, give for his ouster and for being there, for overseeing this insane asylum of political prisoners, of political repression, of summary execution, of torture, of exile, internal and external. If Lavalas were able to participate in the upcoming elections on a fair and even playing field, they would win again. But if they were to win again, what would that say about the official rationale and the official justification given for ousting Aristide, which again was that he had lost the support of his people, that this wasn't, he left an unpopular leader. That was what they told the world. That was their rationale for ousting him, for supporting his removal from office. And I really don't think it's more complex than that. If Lavalas were to win the upcoming elections, it would expose this lie for what it is. It would expose that this was a movement not of a broad sector of Haitian society calling for Aristide's resignation, but this was the traditional economic elite, along with funding institutions like the United States Agency for International Development and the Canadian International Development Agency, funding and building the face and the appearance of a broad-based opposition that, in fact, really has done nothing but represented and brought back the same traditional economic elites that were part of the problem in the first place. And then where do you go from there if that's exposed? You're back at zero. And the U.S. has invested too much to go back to zero at this point. So how do you keep Lavalas from playing, from entering the elections on a fair and even playing field? You obliterate it. You attempt to destroy it. You attempt to exterminate it so that the majority political party, the largest political party, is in tatters as those elections come about. I mean, come on, thousands upon thousands of Haitians murdered and killed preparing for those elections. Thousands of political prisoners preparing for those elections. Thousands more forced into internal exile and external exile. That's how these elections have been prepared for. And the United Nations has overseen this entire process. Not only have they been complicit in it, in the process of the repression committed by the Haitian National Police, committed by Haiti's judicial system, committed by the U.S.-installed government, but now the United Nations stands accused of direct repression against supporters of the Lavalas movement, direct acts of terror designed to forestall and diminish the calls for Aristide's return and for the restoration of democracy. I will never look at the United Nations the same way ever again.
And on that note, thank you. Thank you for this conversation, and thank you for the wonderful work you did at the Haitian Tribunal, and for the good work you continue to do.
Honor and a pleasure. Thank you.